previously on the history of America's 1%.
So, with the book now closed on the Astor family dynasty, we take a look at some of the other families who grasped their wealth by obtaining land in the heart of the burgeoning cities of America through grants from corrupt government administrations and other fraudulent activities. In getting together their fortunes, the Goulets, the Rhinelanders, and the Schermerhorns all closely followed the means and methods of the Astors. The Rhinelanders were quite conspicuous personages in the corruption-plagued Tammany Hall machine. In banking, the Schermerhorns were directors of the Bank of New York, and the Goulets were deeply involved in the chartering of the Chemical Bank, which was proved in government investigations to be conceived in bribery and corruption. In Cincinnati, the methods of Nicholas Longworth mimicked those of Astor. He also had acquired land in the heart of the young city, which grew in value exponentially with the increased population of settlement in the West. And in Chicago, the fortunes of Marshall Field and Levi Leiter Hall had their origins in owning city lands. Field specifically was involved with a contracting firm during the Civil War, which defrauded the government and the soldiers. Many of these rich American families would go on to marry into the financially ailing families of European nobilities. Several also became financially involved in later generations with the great railroad magnates and their colossal thefts and looting. Gus notes that the crimes of one generation become the glories of the next.
You get up and howl about America and democracy. There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today. We no longer live in a world of nations and ideologies. The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
To another episode of the History of America's 1%, the podcast series where we dive into the long and shadowy history of America's ruling elite through the works of authors who were either silenced, suppressed, or forgotten. We're going to be getting in now. This is episode 14 of the podcast, and we are continuing once again the very, very important and critical work by a real muckraking author and historian, Gustavus Myers, and we're reading his 1909 book, The History of the Great American Fortunes. And so far, we've begun to really dig into the era of the robber barons. We've just wrapped up looking at John Jacob Astor and a few of the other notable fortunes that came from owning land in the growing cities of America. And now we're going to look at some of the fortunes, and one in particular of a man who was out in the West, quote-unquote, as it was considered back then, which would be Chicago. And this man is Marshall Field. Well, Gus Myers touched on Marshall Field a bit in the last chapter of the book. That'll be episode number 13 of this podcast, where we looked at that. But now he's going to dive into Field's fortune in a greater extent. And before we get into the book, I figured, as always, we'll read a little bit about this quote-unquote titan of industry from a very mainstream and vanilla source. And, of course, that great wellspring of truthful truthiness, as it were, Wikipedia. So let's take a look at Marshall Field's biography on Wikipedia. He was born August 18, 1834, and died January 16, 1906. Marshall Field was an American entrepreneur and founder of Marshall Field & Company, the Chicago-based department stores. His business was renowned for its then-exceptional level of quality and customer service. Field is also known for some of his philanthropic donations, providing funding for the Field Museum of Natural History, and donating land for the campus of the University of Chicago. In his early life, he was born on a farm in Conway, Franklin County, Massachusetts, the son of John Field IV and wife Fidelia Nash. His family was descended from Puritans who came to America as early as 1650. At the age of 17, he moved to Pittsfield in Massachusetts, where he first worked in a dry goods store. He left Massachusetts at the age of 18 for new opportunities in the rapidly expanding West. In 1856, at age 21, he went to live with his brother in Chicago, Illinois, and obtained employment at leading dry goods merchant Cooley Wadsworth and Company, which was to become Cooley Farewell and Company in 1857. The career of Marshall Field. In 1862, Field purchased a partnership with the reorganized firm of Farewell Field and Company, or Farwell Field and Company. In January 1865, Field and a partner, Levi Leiter, who we also looked at in the last chapter of Gustavus Meyer's book, accepted an offer to become senior partners at the dry goods establishment of Potter Palmer. The new firm became known as Field Palmer Leiter and Company. In 1867, after Field and Leiter could afford to buy him out, Palmer withdrew from the firm and it was renamed Field Leiter and Company. Like many Chicago businessmen, Field's company was badly affected by the Great Chicago Fire of 1871, but reopened relatively quickly. The company also survived the Panic of 1873 because of their relatively low levels of debt. By 1881, Field had forced Leiter to sell his share of the business and change the store's name to Marshall Field & Company. He took an early 19th century consumer landscape that was centered around the principle of caveat emptor, or buyer beware, and transformed it into a plush shopping experience fit for the Gilded Age. Unconditional refunds, consistent pricing, and international imports are among the Field innovations that became standards in quality retailing. Field's employees were also instructed not to push products on uninterested customers, as was common practice in stores of the period. The quotes, quote, give the lady what she wants, unquote, and, quote, the customer is always right, unquote, are attributed to Field, though the latter may also be an invention of Harry Gordon Selfridge while employed by Field. Though most famous today for his retail business, during his lifetime his wholesale business made him far more money. During the 1880s, Field's wholesale business generated 5 times more revenue than retail annually. The wholesale business even had its own landmark building, the Marshall Fields Wholesale Store, erected in 1887. Revenue from the Marshall Fields retail business did not surpass the company's wholesale business until after Field's death. Field was highly suspicious of organized labor throughout his career and prohibited unionization among his employees. During the time of the Haymarket Riot, the wives of the defendants initiated an appeal to which all of the local businessmen agreed, except Field. Journalist and reformer Harry DeMars Lloyd led a national campaign to grant clemency. Even bankers like Lyman J. Gage favored clemency, believing that moderation would lead to improved relations between capital and labor. Potter Palmer and Charles Hutchinson were inclined to agree, but Marshall Field was not. A number of other men confided to Gage that they were not willing to publicly disagree with Field, the wealthiest and most powerful businessman in Chicago. Field would also oppose organized labor during the Teamsters strike in 1905. Personal life. Field avoided political and social intrigue, instead focusing on his work and on supporting his family and his favorite philanthropies. Oh, of course he did. Field was a very active member of the Commercial Club of Chicago and the Jekyll Island Club, a.k.a. the Millionaires Club on Jekyll Island, Georgia. That should ring a bell. He married Nanny Douglas Scott of Ironton, Ohio, in 1863 and raised two children, Marshall Field Jr. and Ethel Field. After Scott died in 1896, Field married longtime friend Delia Spencer, Widow Catton. I don't know. Anyways, his son Marshall Jr. was married to Albertine Huck, parents of Gwendolyn Mary Field, married to Sir Archibald Charles Edmondson, 6th Baronet. Okay, so he married into royalty there. His daughter Ethel was married to Arthur Maggie Tree, with whom she had one son, Ronald Tree, and then in 1901 to David Beatty, 1st Earl Beatty, with whom she had two sons, David and Peter. So again, going back to Gus Meyer's earlier statements in the book that once they had a ton of money, all that was left was noble titles, and it appears that the progeny of Mr. Marshall Field was no exception into marrying the broke nobles from Europe who needed money. Death of Marshall Field. Field died in New York City, New York, on January 16, 1906, at age 71 from a case of pneumonia contracted after playing golf on New Year's Day with his nephew, his secretary, and Abraham Lincoln's oldest son, Robert Todd. And Wikipedia notes that this claim may be dubious. Field was buried on January 19th, and he is interred in the Graceland Cemetery in Chicago. Now let's look at the most important part, his legacy. After his death, Field's estate was to be held in trust for 40 years by two grandsons, Henry Field and Marshall Field III. Henry Field died in 1917 and thus was unable to collect his inheritance, leaving the Field fortunes in the hands of Marshall Field III. The Field Museum of Natural History was named after him in 1894 after he gave it an endowment of $1 million. Field was initially reluctant to do so, reportedly saying, quote, "I don't know anything about a museum, and I don't care to know anything about a museum. I'm not going to give you $1 million, unquote. However, he later relented after railroad supplies magnate Edward E. Ayer, another early benefactor and later first president of the museum, convinced Field that his everlasting legacy would be achieved by financing the project. The year after his death, the Field Museum received a further $8 million in accordance with his will. The University of Chicago was founded by both Field and New York's John D. Rockefeller to rival nearby Evanston's Northwestern University. A bust of Marshall Field stands aside other early 20th century Chicago industry magnates at the North River Bank on the Chicago River facing the Merchandise Mart. And there you go. There's the biography from Wikipedia. So, not much. He was this brilliant store owner who revolutionized retail sales, and he left a natural history museum, which he wasn't too keen on financing until he realized it was probably the only way to save his reputation through future generations. And he also founded the University of Chicago with John D. Rockefeller. So some very, very interesting connections. And of course, this has all the markings of every other rich potentate and industrial titan from that era. And that, of course, is the hallmarks of whitewashing. So, Let's take a look at the other side of the coin, shall we? Let's jump in now. This is a continued reading from The History of Great American Fortunes by Gustavus Myers. This is Volume 1, Part 2, Chapter 9, The Field Fortune in Extenso. In close similarity to the start of the Astors and many other founders of great land fortunes, commerce was the original means by which Marshall Field obtained the money which he invested in land. Consecutively came a ramification of other revenue-producing properties. Once in motion, the process worked in the same admixed, interconnected way as it did in the amassing of contemporary large fortunes. It may be literally compared to hundreds of golden streams flowing from as many sources to one central point. From land, business, railroads, street railways, public utility, and industrial corporations, from these and many other channels, prodigious profits kept and still keep pouring in ceaselessly. In turn, these formed ever newer and widening distributing radii of investments. The process, by its own resistless volition, became one of continuous compound progression. Land for almost nothing. Long before the business of the firm of Marshall Field & Company had reached the annual total of $50 million, Field, Leiter, and their associates had begun buying land in Chicago. Little capital was needed for the purpose. The material growth of Chicago explains sufficiently how a few dollars put in land 75 or 90 years ago became in time an automatically increasing fund of millions. A century or so ago, the log cabin of John Kinsey, last name K-I-N-Z-I-E, was the only habitation on a site now occupied by a swarming conglomerate, rushing population of 3,376,483. Footnote number 1. Where the prairie land once stretched in solitude, a huge, roaring, choking city now stands, black with factories, the habitat of nearly 3.5 millions of human beings, living in a whirlpool of excitement and tumult, presenting extremes of wealth and poverty, the many existing in dire straits, the few rolling in sovereign luxury. Land in the infancy of the city was cheap. Few settlers there were, and the future could not be foreseen. In 1830, 1/4 acre could be bought for $20. A few bits of silver, or any currency whatsoever, would secure to the buyer a deed carrying with it a title forever, with a perpetual right of exclusive ownership and a perpetual hold upon all succeeding generations. The more population grew, the greater the value their labor gave the land, and the keener their need, the more difficult it became for them to get land. Within 10 years, by about the beginning of the year 1840, the price of a 1/4 acre in the center of the city had risen to $1,500. A decade later, the established value was $17,500, and in 1860, $28,000. Chicago was growing with great rapidity. A network of railroads converged there. Mammoth factories, mills, grain elevators, and packing houses, a vast variety of manufacturing and mercantile concerns, set up in business, and brought thither swarms of working men and their families, led on by the need of food and the prospects of work. The greater the influx of workers, the more augmented became the value of land. Inevitably, the greatest congestion of living resulted. By 1870, the price of a 1/4 acre in the heart of the city bounded to $120,000, and by 1880 to $130,000. It becomes worth millions. During the next decade, a decade full of bitter distress to the working population of the United States and marked by widespread suffering. The price shot up to $900,000. By 1894, a panic year in which millions of men were out of work and in a state of appalling destitution, a quarter of an acre reached the gigantic value of $1,250,000. Footnote number 2. At this identical time, large numbers of the working class, which had so largely created this value, were begging vainly for work and were being evicted by the tens of thousands in Chicago because they could not pay rent for their miserable, cramped habitations. By exchanging a few hundred or a few thousand dollars in Chicago's extreme youth for a scrap of paper called a deed, the buyer of this land found himself, after the lapse of years, a millionaire. It did not matter where or how he obtained the purchase money, whether he swindled or stole or inherited it or made it honestly. So long as it was not counterfeit, the law was observed. After he got the land, he was under no necessity of doing anything more than hold on to it, which, saying he could do equally well whether in Chicago or buried in the depths of Kamchatka. If he chose, he could get chronically drunk. He could gamble or drone in laziness. He could do anything but work. Nevertheless, the land and all its values which others created were his forever, to enjoy and dispose of as suited his individual pleasure. This was, and is still, the system. Thoroughly riveted in law, it was regarded as a rational, beneficent, and everlasting fixture of civilized life by the beneficiaries. And as these latter happened to be, by virtue of their possessions, among the real rulers of government, their conceptions and interests were embodied in law, thought, and custom as the edict of civilization. The whole concurrent institutions of society, which were but the echo of property interests, pronounced the system wise and just, and as a reigning force do still proclaim it. In such a state, there was nothing abnormal in any man monopolizing land and exclusively appropriating its revenues. On the contrary, it was considered a superior stroke of business, a splendid example of astuteness. Marshall Field was looked upon as a very sagacious businessman. Field's Real Estate Tracts. Field bought much land when it was of comparatively inconsequential value and held on to it with a tenacious grip. In the last years of his life, his revenues from his real estate were uninterruptedly enormous. Downtown real estate in Chicago, wrote a quote-unquote popular writer in a typically effusive biographical account of Field published in 1901, quote, is about as valuable, foot for foot, as that in the best locations in New York City. From $8,000 to $15,000 a front foot are not uncommon figures for property north of Congress Street in the Chicago business district. Marshall Field owns not less than 20 choice sites and buildings in this section, not including those used for his dry goods business. In the vicinity of the Chicago University buildings, he owns square block after block of valuable land. Yet farther south, he owns hundreds of acres of land in the Calumet region, land invaluable for manufacturing purposes. Unquote. This extension and centralization of land ownership were accompanied by precisely the same results as were witnessed in other cities, although these results were the sequence of the whole social and industrial system, and not solely of any one phase. Poverty grew in exact proportion to the growth of large fortunes. The one presupposed and was built upon the existence of the other. Chicago became full of slums and fetid, overcrowded districts, and if the density and congestion of population are not as great in New York, Boston, and Cincinnati, It is only because of more favorable geographical conditions. Field's fortune was heaped up in about the last 20 years of his life. The celerity of its progress arose from the prolific variety and nature of his possessions. To form even an approximate idea of how fast wealth came into him, it is necessary to picture millions of men, women, and children toiling day after day, year in and year out, getting a little less than 2 parts of the value of what they produced, while almost 9 portions either went to him entirely or in part. But this was not all. Add to these millions of workers the rest of the population of the United States who had to buy from, or in some other way pay tribute to, the many corporations in which Field held stock, and you get some adequate conception of the innumerable influxions of gold which poured into Field's coffers every minute, every second of the day. Whether he were awake or asleep, whether sick or well, whether traveling or sitting stock still. His income, $500 to $700 an hour. This one man had the legal power of taking over to himself as his inalienable property, his to enjoy, hoard, squander, bury, or throw in the ocean, if his fancy so dictated, the revenue produced by the labor of millions of beings as humans as he, with the same born capacity for eating, drinking, breathing, sleeping, and dying. Many of his workers had a better digestive apparatus which had to put up with inferior food and, at times, no food at all. He could eat no more than 3 meals a day, but his daily income was enough to have afforded him 10,000 sumptuous daily meals with exquisite trimmings, while periods came when those who drudged for him were fortunate to have any meals at all. Few of his workers received as much as $2 a day. Field's income was estimated to be at the rate of about $500 to $700 an hour. First, and of prime importance, was his wholesale and retail dry goods business. This was and is a line of business in which frantic competition survived long after the manufacturing field had passed over into concentrated trust control. To keep apace with competitors and make high profits, it was imperative not only to resort to shifts, expedients, and policies followed by competitors, but to improve upon and surpass those methods if possible. Field at all times proved that it was possible. No competing firm would pay a certain rate of wages, but what Field instantly outgeneraled it by cutting his workers' wages to a point enabling him to make his goods as cheap or cheaper. Oh, nice. So there's something they never mentioned in the book. He continually was cutting his workers' wages. Okay, here we go, and Gus is going to elaborate on this, so let's continue on. His employees' wretched wages. In his wholesale and retail stores, he employed not fewer than 10,000 men, women, and children. He compelled them to work for wages which, in a large number of cases, were inadequate even for a bare subsistence. 95% received $12 a week or less. The female sewing machine operators who bent over their tasks the long day, making the clothes sold in Field stores, were paid the miserable wages of $6.75 a week. Makers of socks and stockings were paid from $4.57 to $4.75 a week. The working hours were 59 a week. Field also manufactured his own furniture as well as many other articles. Furniture workers were paid, machine workers, $11.02, and upholsterers, $12.47 a week. All of Field's wage workers were paid by the hour. Should they fall sick or work become slack, their pay was proportionately reduced. The wretchedness in which many of these workers lived was pitiful in the extreme. Even in a small town where rent is not so high, these paltry wages would have been insufficient for an existence of partial decency. But in Chicago, with its forbidding rents, the increasing cost of all necessaries, and all of the other expenses incident to life in a large city, their wages were notoriously scanty. Large numbers of them were driven to herding in foul tenements or evil dwellings, the inducements of which was the rent, a little lighter than could be had elsewhere. Every cent economized meant much. If an investigator, as often happened, had observed them and he had followed them to their wretched homes after their day's work, he would have noted or learned of these conditions. Their food was circumscribed and coarse. The very cheapest forms of meat and usually stale bread. Butter was a superfluous luxury. The morning meal was made up of a chunk of bread washed down with quote-unquote coffee, adulterated stuff with just a faint odor of real coffee. At noon, bread and an onion or a bit of herring or a slice of cheap cheese composed their dinner, with perhaps a dash of dessert in the shape of a sweetened substance, artificially colored, sold as quote-unquote sake or sake. I'm not sure exactly how that's pronounced. For supper, cheap pork or a soup bone garnished occasionally in the season by stale vegetables and accompanied by a concoction resembling tea. Few of these workers ever had more than one suit of clothes or more than one dress. They could not afford amusements and were too fatigued to read or converse. At night, bunches of them bunked together, sometimes 8 or 10 in a single room. By this arrangement, the rent of each was proportionately reduced. As to the charge, common at the time, that the low wages were the prime factor driving many girls and women into the business of prostitution, we have to approach the subject with many reservations. An article on prostitution in Chicago by George Kibbe Turner, last name T-U-R-N-E-R, in McClure's magazine, April 1907, declared that young girl victims were, quote, especially the low-paid employees of department stores and factories which furnish the majority of the English-speaking women in the profession in Chicago, unquote. In his rather sensational and vitriolic raking of Chicago, If Christ Came to Chicago, William T. Stead, a noted British writer, dealt with the alleged effects of department store conditions in filling the ranks of prostitutes. And the reports of industrial commissions followed the same general lines. Footnote number 3. And in this footnote, Gus Myers remarks that, for instance, the report of the U.S. Industrial Commission of 1900, after giving the low wages paid to women in the different cities, it said, quote, it is manifest from the figures given that the amount of earnings in many cases is less than the actual cost of the necessities of life. This existence of such a state of affairs must inevitably lead in many cases to the adoption of a life of immorality. And in fact, there is no doubt that the low rate of wages paid to women is one of the most frequent causes of prostitution. The fact that the great mass of working women maintain their virtue in spite of low wages and dangerous environment is highly creditable to them. Unquote. And that comes from the final report of the Industrial Commission, published 1902, volume or chapter 19, page 927. Continuing now with the book. At that period, it was as much the indiscriminate style to attribute such results wholly to economic causes as a century previously. It had been the custom to view prostitution as the certain evidence of quote-unquote innate depravity. A more judicious or comprehensive view now recognizes a variety of leading or contributing factors, and although economic pressure does, of course, have a direct effect, yet too little is definitely known of all of the remoter causes to warrant full acceptance of one-sided and sweeping statements. Field was an astute organizer. He understood how to manipulate and use other men, and how to centralize business and to cut out the waste of mercantile operations. In the evolutionary scheme of business, he played his important part, and a very necessary part it was, for which he must be given full credit. His methods were in no respect different from those of the rest of the commercial world as a whole. The only difference was that he was more conspicuous and more successful, centering all profits in himself. At a time when all business was run on the chaotic and desultory lines characteristic of the purely competitive age, he had the foresight and the shrewdness to perceive that the storekeeper who depended upon the jobber and the manufacturer for his goods was largely at the mercy of those elements. Even if he were not, there were two sets of profits between him and the making of the goods, the jobber's profit and the manufacturer's. Years before this vital fact was impressed upon the minds of the floundering retailers, Field understood and acted upon it. He became his own manufacturer and jobber. Thus he was complacently able to supply his department store with many goods at cost, and pocket the profits that otherwise would have gone to jobber and manufacturer. In, however, the very act of making three sets of profits, while many other stores made only one set, Field paid his employees at the retail store rate. That is to say, he paid no more in wages than the store, which had to buy often from the jobber, who in turn purchased from the manufacturer. With this salient fact in mind, one begins to get a clear insight into some of the reasons why Field made such enormous profits, and an understanding of the consequent contrast of his firm doing a business of $50 million a year, while thousands of his employees had to work for a pittance. He could have afforded to have paid them many times more than they were getting and still would have made large profits. But this would have been an imbecilic violation of that established canon of business. Pay your employees as little as you can and sell your goods for the highest price you can get. Field was one of the biggest dry goods manufacturers in the world. He owned, a writer set forth, scores of enormous factories in England, Ireland, and Scotland. The provinces of France, this eulogist went on, quote, are dotted with his mills. The clatter of the Marshall Field looms is heard in Spain, Italy, Germany, Austria, and Russia. Nor is the Orient neglected by this master of fabrics. Plodding Chinese and the skilled Japs are numbered by the thousands on the payroll of the Chicago merchant and manufacturer. On the other side of the equator are vast woolen mills in Australia, and the chain extends to South America, with factories in Brazil and in other neighboring republics. Unquote. In all of these factories, the labor of men, women, and children was harshly exploited. In nearly all of them, the workers were in an unorganized state and therefore deprived of every vestige of self-protection. Boys and girls of tenderest age were mercilessly ground into dollars. Their young life's blood dyed deep the fabrics which brought Field riches. Wow. In this dehumanizing business, Field was only doing what the entire commercial aristocracy the world over was doing. How extraordinarily profitable the business of Marshall Field and Company was may be seen in the fact that its shares, it became an incorporated stock company, were worth $1,000 each. At his death, Marshall Field owned 3,400 of these shares, which the executors of his estate valued at $3,400,000. Yep. From sources described came the money with which Field became a large landowner. Also, he became an industrial monarch. The inventory of his estates filed in court by his executors revealed that he owned stocks and bonds in about 150 corporations, and he was a director of many. This itemized list showed that he owned many millions of bonds and stocks in railroads, with the construction and operation of which he had nothing to do. The history of many of them reeked with thefts of public and private money, corruption of common councils and legislatures, Congress, and of administrative officials, land grabbing, fraud, illegal transactions, violence, and oppression, not only of their immediate workers, but of the entire population. He owned, to give a few instances, $1,500,000 of Baltimore and Ohio stock, $600,000 of Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe, $1,860,000 of Chicago and Northwestern, and tens of millions more of the stock or bonds of about 15 other railroads. He also owned an immense assortment of the stocks of a large number of trusts. The affairs of these trusts have been shown in court at some time or other as overflowing with fraud, the most glaring oppressions and violations of law. He had $450,000 in stock of the Corn Products Company, a.k.a. the Glucose Trust, $350,000 of Biscuit Trust stock, $200,000 of American Tin Can Company, a.k.a. the Tin Can Trust stock, and large amounts of stock in other trusts as an example of the methods of trusts in which Field owns stock. We shall briefly refer to several of the mass of facts contained in a government investigation of the Harvester Trust. His holdings in this were $370,000 worth of shares. The International Harvester Company had been organized in 1902 by the consolidation of five principal manufacturers of harvesting machines. It dominated the industry chiefly, quote, by monopolistic combination, certain unfair competitive methods, and superior command of capital, unquote. In years preceding Field's death, it paid on its actual assets dividends of from 11.5% to nearly 13.5%. Footnote number 5. The United States Steel Corporation, the Steel Trust, of which Field was a director, is dealt with elsewhere in this book. All of his stocks and bonds Field owned outright. He made it a rule never to buy a share of stock on margin or for speculative purposes. All told, he owned more than $55 million in stocks and bonds. A very considerable part of these were securities of Chicago Surface and Elevated Railway, Gas, Electric Light, and Telephone Companies, in the securing of the franchises of some of which corruption had been notorious. Alright, that's the end of Chapter 9. I barely got through it. Yeah, anyways, so Marshall Field, he's kind of unwrapping some of his business interests, and I think the next chapter we're going to continue on about Marshall Field, and get into some of the methods of these holdings and things that he had. But very interesting. He was definitely a large holder in a bunch of different companies. I gotta admit, though, I'm having a little trouble reading this copy of the book. The print is very small, but I finally went ahead and found a hard copy of the book from a super awesome guy who sold it for $6 to me. So you can still find copies of this book out there somewhere. They're not terribly expensive now, although I see commonly it going for between I think $30 to $50 usually. But anyways, this is a printing. I looked in the front of the book. This is a printing from 1964. 1964 edition. So this alleges that it's been updated. I don't know if that's true or not, but I'm going to start reading from this and see maybe if there's some additional information in here. They say it's been updated to become a whole new book, but, you know, that's sometimes you gotta sell a product. This is published by the Modern Library, and oddly enough, there's still spelling errors in here, so I guess they didn't go back through and try to fix that. Or grammatical errors. So that's why I'm having a little trouble reading it. But anyways, enough about that. I hope you enjoyed this reading, further reading, of The History of Great American Fortunes by Gustavus Myers, a book originally published in 1909, and one that's very illuminating to the methods and, I don't want to say villainies, but, you know, as Gus Myers states clearly, this was just the times it was, I'm sure a lot of these people were good, but they were compelled to, adopt methods which impoverished large amounts of people and totally exploited them. And so the robber barons, who I don't think ever went away, merely pulled a shroud over themselves and covered themselves, they still exist today. And I think we're starting to see that, and people are really recognizing that, especially on Wall Street, with all the panics and problems we've been having, especially since 2007, and all the bailouts and rescuing of different companies and this and that, and people are starting to get the idea that, hey, are we entering once again into a age of robber barons, and maybe not so much men who exploit industry, but those who exploit laws, as was, initially started under this class, this original cast of industrial titans. And maybe now we're seeing the further revision and extension of their methods. Anyways, join us next time on the History of America's 1%, where we continue to look at, of course, the history that you are not supposed to know.
Of the pie, we all wanna be cool. We're all out to get it. What we want, we can't decide. I ain't nobody's tool. Sometimes I'm used to cut a slice of the pie. We all wanna